This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This is Open to Debate. I'm John Donvan. Today, in honor of Women's History Month, we are taking on the gender wage gap, why it still exists, and whether there's anything to do about it. It's a question that has broad implications for our economy and even men as well. For this one, I asked the fantastic Naima Raza to step in to moderate. Naima is a journalist with New York Magazine and Vox Media. Now, onto the show.
One of the things I love about working with Open to Debate is that they don't pay me any less than the men. And that's relevant because according to research from the U.S. Department of Labor, women are earning about 84 cents on the dollar to a man in the year 2021. And by that same measurement, it's been in the 80-odd percent range for the last 20 years. Today, we're going to be tackling this question of should we address the gender wage gap? I want to zoom in on that question because it's not really about whether there's a gender wage gap to address. Our guests today actually agree on that fact. They might have some quibbles about whether it's this big or that big, but the question is whether policymakers should actually try to address the gender wage gap. So let me introduce our debaters without further ado. Arguing yes to the question, should we address the wage gap, is Katie Ward-Philp. I should disclaim that Katie is a Canadian, where government intervention and regulation is less contentious, I would say, wouldn't you, Katie, than over in the United States?
That is true. Absolutely.
Katie is the Commissioner and Chief Administrative Officer of the Pay Equity Commission of Ontario, a government entity that has been really focused on economic development strategies to lift up marginalized communities. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you.
And arguing no to the question, should we address the gender wage gap, is Alison Schrager. Alison's work bridges many fields. She's an economist. She's a writer. She's also worked in finance. And these days, she's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing writer for Bloomberg Opinion. Welcome, Alison.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we start, I just want to set the stage a little bit and help our listeners understand you each a bit better and what brought you to the table for this debate. I'm curious if you've experienced the wage gap, the gender wage gap, in your own career and how that personal experience has shaped your argument here today. Maybe, Katie, I'll ask you first.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of things I could say about that, but the first thing I will say is one of my very first corporate jobs, my CEO introduced me to the board of directors, which was about 18 men and one woman, by saying, I'm going to have this one's knees sewn shut so I don't have to pay her maternity leave. And at that moment, I realized having a fertile body at work was a detriment to my pay, my productivity, the amount of investment that my employer was going to make in me relative to my male peers. And so it really shaped the way I thought about being a woman at work and the impact that biology has on pay, on the prospect of career growth.
Thank you for sharing that. And I'm sorry you had that experience. Alison, same question to you. Have you come across this? I believe when you were studying economics, you're one of the few women in the cohort.
Yeah, I mean, we were actually all paid the same because, you know, you just get your fellowship and that's that. I actually did once have a realization. I was always convinced I had a very hard time in graduate school because, I was one of very few women. Economics is known for being tough on women PhDs. But then I remember a couple of years ago, I was having a drink with a friend from graduate school, and he was telling me how graduate school was the worst time of his life, too. And it dawned on me, I'm sure maybe I did have a harder time than him from time to time, but I wasn't able to control for what made that about being female and what just made that about the fact that graduate school is kind of awful.
You're a third time debater on the show. So you keep coming back. What brings you back?
I'm terrified every time. It's so hard. But I know I like a challenge and it's my job to put ideas out there. And I feel like don't put ideas out there if you can't defend them. Or maybe you can, but like at least try.
Katie, what made you so motivated to show up here today to debate?
I remember in 2001 reading Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. And the book was about poverty in the U.S. But the unstated subject was women. It was the women who were primarily in the poverty working class. And that really shaped my career in economic development, really focused on getting women's participation in order to break those poverty cycles.
I'm very excited for this debate, and I think it'd be a great time to hear your opening arguments. So, Katie, you're answering yes to the question of should we address the gender wage gap? So I'm going to let you go first. Please take a few minutes and outline your argument for us here today.
Yes, I am arguing that the gender wage gap needs to be addressed because it can be addressed through decisive policy action. You know, the gender wage gap was once 59 cents on the male dollar in 1960, and it's now about 84 cents. And this cannot be credited merely to the invisible hand of the market. This happened because of activism, changing social norms, changing labor dynamics, and through various forms of targeted proactive legislations. In fact, governments that have recognized that the gender pay gap is multifaceted and requires policy intervention are making huge strides in actually reducing its severity. My office did an analysis of OECD, ILO, Eurostat, and World Economic Forum data, and we found some really consistent patterns. Government interventions tailored to specific local contexts work in closing gender wage gaps. And these interventions include a spectrum of measures from pay equity legislation, anti-discrimination law, pay transparency initiatives, universal childcare, and parental leave policies. So, you know, consider the case of the United States, where there is a really interesting patchwork of state-level initiatives that offer valuable insight here. So states like California and Massachusetts, with long-standing equal pay laws and measures to address discrimination, are showing tangible progress, which with wage gaps lower than the national average. Or conversely, you can take a state like Mississippi with belated legislative action, only adopting equal pay laws in 2022, lagging behind with far greater gaps than the national average. So this underscores a crucial role that policy intervention can play in addressing the gaps. You know, the economic imperative also cannot be overstated. A McKinsey Global Institute report estimates that narrowing the gap could add trillions to the global GDP, underscoring the immense potential of gender equality as an engine of economic prosperity. And moreover, you know, the gender wage gap is reflected, I would say, in how the market values and rewards certain types of work over others. Women's work has been erroneously categorized as merely an extension of their unpaid domestic roles, inherently tied to, you know, caregiving and household management, and less deserving of esteem, and by extension, less compensation. So the devaluation of female-dominated industries reflects a systemic failure of the market to actually recognize the value of women's labor. Historical precedents such as protective laws actually illustrate these entrenched biases that have marginalized women's contributions in the workforce. So we need to address the gap because the market is unable to untangle societal ideas about women's value from the value of the work that they actually perform. Related to this, we have to confront the fallacy of individual choice in actually shaping career trajectories. While personal preference undoubtedly influences occupational paths, you got to consider that societal norms, discriminatory practices, and legislative frameworks actually exert profound influence. Gender stereotypes ingrained from childhood steer individuals towards certain occupations while creating barriers to entry in others. Finally, the burden of unpaid care work disproportionately falls on women, constraining their ability to participate in the paid labor market. The absence of universal childcare and paid family leave exasperates these disparities, with the effect of actually hindering women's professional advancement and perpetuating the motherhood penalty. The gender wage gap is not merely a statistical artifact, but a symptom of entrenched inequalities that demand urgent policy interventions. And by embracing proactive measures to address discrimination and promote pay equity, we can finally level the playing field for women.
Thank you, Katie. Allison, it's time for your opening argument. We'd love to hear from you why you're arguing no to this question.
Well, I agree that there is definitely a gender wage gap. I mean, that is undeniable. As you said, it's 82, 81 cents on the dollar, 83, that women get paid for men. And that is after years of progress in the last couple of decades. This convergence has stalled. I know we're not going to debate the data, but I think it's important to take a hard look at the data. Because as an economist, I feel like when you come up with a policy prescription, you have to be very precise in the exact nature of the problem that you're addressing. And make sure that you're addressing the underlying problem. And if this difference is all due to discrimination, then there's more need for policy. But if it's due to, say, various choices or just sort of actual market signals, then it actually can be counterproductive. So what is driving this? Now, as Katie pointed out, some of it is the choices or, say, social norms that drive women into certain careers. Social workers get paid less than engineers. That is for a lot of reasons, but, you know, that is the market wage of social workers versus engineers. That drives some of it. But let's be honest, even when we control for occupation, there's still a gender wage gap. So we have to dig even a little bit deeper. Some of it is hours worked. Women do work fewer hours, largely because of childcare. For instance, OBGYNs. Now, here's a job where you would think women would have a huge advantage. Women prefer women doctors. But even male OBGYNs get paid more than females. Why? Because they are more likely to get up in the middle of the night and deliver a baby. And that makes a big difference on your wages, is the ability and desire to work a lot of hours. And even then, even when you account for different hours, you still have a bit of a gap. I mean, we're now less than 10%, but that's not nothing. And, you know, it's not fair. So let's look even a little deeper. So then what we also see is the gender wage gap narrowing to almost nothing earlier in your career, and it widens throughout the course of your career, which is the motherhood penalty that Katie just mentioned. Once women have children, their wages do fall relative to men. Educated women tend to end up with a bigger penalty. And, you know, Claudia Golden, who just won the Nobel Prize, her work finds that that's because certain jobs really, she calls them greedy, want you to be there at their beck and call. Like I said, the biggest wage gaps tend to be things like corporate law, banking, places where they want you to be there all the time available to your client. And this is really drives a lot of this gender wage gap, particularly for that segment of the labor market. And the studies that she has done and others have done on law students and MBAs find that when women have children, they really crave and need a lot more flexibility. And flexibility, you know, employers don't like to give it to people. And not just because they're greedy, but because it's valuable having employees who are available. We've all had jobs. And we all know that, you know, being there when your employer wants you to is really valuable to them. And it's a trade-off. As an economist, I like to think about compensation more holistically than just salary. There's also benefits. There's health benefits. There's vacations. Flexibility is also a benefit. And it's a trade-off. A lot of women, you know, some of it is societal norms, but it's also some women genuinely desire to be there and be present for their children's childhood. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, we see the biggest pay disparities under very educated women who have rich husbands. So they even have access to childcare. They just want to be there with their kids. I think that's why policy has less of a role to play, because what that does is it makes these decisions that are very personal, very unique to the woman, her job, her family, her needs, much more rigid.
Thank you so much, Allison. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to dig deeper into this question of should we address the gender wage gap? Welcome back to Open to Debate. I'm your moderator, Naima Raza, and we're debating the question, should we address the gender wage gap? We've just heard opening statements from our two debaters, Katie Ward-Philp from the Pay Equity Commission of Ontario, and Allison Schrager, who's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. So, Katie, you were saying, look, there hasn't been a lot of progress in the last 20 years. We're still at this 82-84 cent divide. And the market alone has not fixed this, and it won't fix this. And your argument was kind of laying out the fact that policies do work. We've seen this empirically in the experience of states like California, who are early on legislation and regulation around gender equity, versus states like Mississippi, who were late in that regard. So the policies work, that the policies, in fact, can do even more work because there's economic value that's being left on the table when policymakers aren't actually trying to close this divide between women and men when it comes to earning. And then you also made the point that ultimately the gender wage gap is a symptom of, as you put it, societal kind of inequities and miscalculations about the value of work. And that as long as we don't address this, this is going to be a perpetuating failure of the market for time to come. And you pointed specifically to a policy like universal childcare, also paternity or maternity cover, as important issues in kind of addressing this gender wage gap. And Allison, you're actually taking the argument that Katie was so forcefully you know, arguing against, which is you say, look, the market's working. People are making choices and the market is valuing those choices. And you spoke, you know, about the way that work and compensation is structured these days, that the value is on being a beck and call and that women are empirically less willing to be at the beck and call. They crave more flexibility, and that craving, that desire not to work that extra hour of overtime or whatever the case may be, is a choice that women are making to balance. You also said, ultimately, if the economics don't work, the policy won't work, that the policy itself is kind of destined to failure. We've worked on this for, you know, 50 odd years, and we've gotten to the point that we got 20 years ago, and now we might just be at that point.
Yeah, but I don't think we're stuck at this point either.
No, we're not stuck at this point. But I want to start with this very fundamental thing that you two are disagreeing about, which is choice. So really want to understand, you know, it's almost like, Allison, you're saying, look, women are making some choices here. They're making choices that are reflected in the market value of that work, and those choices around kind of work-life balance. You know, I think Katie is kind of arguing it's almost like a choice between not work-life balance, but paid work and unpaid work balance, or, you know, valued work and unvalued work balance. I would be curious how, Allison, you would respond to that.
Well, I mean, it's obviously, as I said, it's different for every woman. As I said, for higher income women, this is a choice. They can afford all the childcare they want. But obviously, a lot of women don't have that choice or have that luxury. I think the question is, though, should we put that on employers or the government to compensate? And I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. Particularly for employers, because then they have to pay extra for workers when they're not there, and that would make them less inclined to hire women.
You're saying there might be even a backlash, that these policies could actually, instead of working, further exacerbate the gap.
Exactly. Like, there is evidence that when you sort of have these blunt sort of policies that says, all right, you have to do equal pay for equal work, it can make people less inclined to hire women.
Katie, how do you respond to that? I mean, first, this idea that the choices are being captured, and two, this idea that actually policy can disincentivize.
So a couple of things. One, I think to, you know, make an argument that women prioritize work-life balance or family life priorities oversimplifies a really complex issue and kind of ignores the fact that there's a lack of infrastructure or support to support her otherwise. And this goes back to the sort of the sort of crafting of gender norms and gender roles, or traditional gender norms and gender roles that we talk about. And we even use this word traditional because, you know, that gives a sense of it's not valuable anymore in today's labor market. We have to rethink the structures and infrastructure that women need to actually participate in the labor market to the level they do. Because there's equally compelling research that shows that women, when they have access to childcare, be it highly subsidized or universal, they're participating in greater numbers. You know, on the point about equal pay for equal work will cause employers to hire less people, I mean, I just look at the labor market right now. Companies
it's not really equal work.
White men, higher salaries.
It's not always equal work. If you're working fewer hours, then it's not equal work.
That is a participation gap, though. I wouldn't call that a pay equity gap. And part of the argument I'm making is that participation is not always a choice. If there's no infrastructure available for you, if there are social, cultural, religious norms or expectations that women are coded to respond to, they don't have the level of choice.
I think part of what Katie's saying, Allison, is that these entire job categories might be less valued because they're dominated by women and they have been undervalued over time. I mean, maybe an example of that is, you know, talked about OBGYNs in your opening statement, but nursing or teaching, these are sectors dominated by women. They tend to be, I think in the pandemic, we look at these jobs and say, oh, they're super essential. And yet the pay in these careers is not reflective of necessarily the essentiality, the essence of that work. Is the market getting this wrong? Is the market valuing work less because it's done by a woman? And even work that's done at home, which is important work, which is valued less, that because it's done by women, it's seen as traditional, as Katie's saying. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, we might not give a lot of teachers and nurses their society due, but I'm not sure if that means they need to also be paid more. As I said, like, it, you know, obviously it depends on the school district, but a lot of teachers are paid better than it appears, partially through other forms of compensation, such as longer vacations and pensions. They're also working largely by the government, as opposed to men who work, say, for an engineering firm or working for the private sector. And that is based generally on, you know, wages are based on, you know, how productive you are and the scarcity of your labor. So I think, you know, as a society, should we give more women their due in a lot of these jobs? Absolutely. But I don't think there's like overwhelming evidence that these women have their productivity devalued in any way.
I'd like to respond to that, Naima, a couple of things. You know, from the onset of participation in the labor market, there was legislation that essentially said, these are the types of work women can do. I mean, you look at protective laws. These were enacted in several states across the U.S. Illinois, Pennsylvania, West Virginia did not allow women to work in mines. Oregon prohibited women from working more than 10 hours a week to keep the work for men. These laws were dismissed. Also, don't forget, up until early 20th century, we had state marrying laws where teachers had to leave the labor force, the teaching once they wed, so that we had to have a legislation to remind women their place. Really, from the onset of the Industrial Revolution, work was coded male or female, and they were paid differently because of that. Because of this undervaluation, we believe women's work was an extension of her unpaid work. And if it's unpaid, it's unvaluable. It's not deserving of the same esteem and compensation. But really, it's only been about 70 or 80 years since men and women have been mixing in the labor market. And there's this incredible US-based longitudinal study that actually looked at occupational feminization from 1950 to the 2000, so a 50-year study, showing that when women actually moved into occupations in large numbers, those jobs began paying less, even after controlling for education, work experience, skills, race, and geography. So there's substantial evidence that shows that when employers place less value on a job, if it can be done by women. And so I can give you some examples of designers. When women became designers, wages fell by 34%. Biologists, wages fell by 18%. And the actual reverse is true. When men go into the space, if it becomes attractive to men, computer programming, for instance, if you recall, it was a relatively menial role done by women in these big computer call center rooms. But when male programmers began to outnumber female ones, the job began paying more and gained prestige. So it's not that women pick low paid jobs. It's literally in terms of skill. It's that the employers and the market devalue them because women are doing them.
So Allison, Katie's raising an interesting study here, which shows almost, she's arguing a cause and effect. Women are entering and then these wages are changing. Have you seen that in your research? And how would you explain that phenomenon?
Well, I think it's more of a correlation than a causation. First of all, when it comes to programmers, I mean, programming also became a lot more computationally demanding and required different skills, and skills that honestly became a lot more scarce. So that's one of the reasons why that pay gap opened up. And in some of the women's professions, there was also just a larger pool of labor available. So it's not simple. You can't just say, well, more women are in it. There's other confounding variables and structures that changed in these jobs. Although I think Katie is right that policy did do a lot to get us to where we are now. And it did close the gap quite a bit. I just don't think policy is the right answer to go this last mile, especially because there are market forces. Katie is talking a lot about participation and that women have lower participation rates. But you know what? Like, we're seeing that gap close, especially because I was talking earlier about how valuable flexibility is to women, but also employers don't want to give it. Well, that's changing too because of remote work, because of gig work. What we're seeing now is flexibility is less valuable to employers. They're more willing to give it. And so what we're seeing is post-pandemic, when the work from home revolution happened, is that women's labor force participation is higher than it was pre-pandemic, whereas men's, it had been falling over the years, is pretty much at the same level as it was pre-pandemic.
There is, when you look at the data about the gender wage gap, there is this tightening that's happening between the 60s and the 80s, and then it gets to the aughts and it kind of pauses. And I guess the question is, have we hit a ceiling? And I was looking at the data from Ontario, even Katie, where you are, and their pay equity legislation was introduced, I think, in the 1980s, 1987, but it hasn't evened the gap. I think there's still an 11% gap today. So do you find that there's just this intractable layer to it?
You know, when I look at global data, there's other type forms of addressing the problem. So when I look at a country like Belgium, which has a 1.2% gender wage gap, highly subsidized, widely available childcare, very robust parental leave policies, this obviously fixes the participation gap. This obviously creates the flexibility that Allison mentioned, that parents both want. We use the language, we talk about parental leave because it should not be maternity leave. It should be on mothers. And we have robust policy programs to promote parental leave. But when you look at even, you know...
Sorry, I actually want to pause for a second because I would love to hear from Allison on this particular policy, on a policy lever of universal childcare. There are places, I mean, Katie's talking about the research over, you know, outside of just the U.S. and looking at Scandinavia, for example, in Norway, there are stipends for parents who are at home or for, you know, for the child, for childcare effectively. Do you think that we should not address the wage gap with universal childcare as a policy, for example?
Well, I'm all for universal or more affordable childcare. I mean, who isn't? I mean, it is, you know, we should do everything we can to make, you know, motherhood and parenthood in general more accessible. I just don't think the evidence shows that that goes a long way to addressing the gender pay gap, because as I said, women still want the flexibility to be there for sort of those moments, for to be engaged in their children's lives. And I said one of the studies shows that some of the women who take the biggest wage penalty are high income women who can afford all the childcare they want.
Can I ask about that though? Part of the research also shows that the way that we think about maternity cover is 6 weeks or 6 months is actually insufficient for the bonding period of time versus places like the UK where they have a year of cover. So is it possible that the policy is just like a blunt hammer rather than a nuanced instrument, but policy could work?
Yeah, well, I mean, it also depends on what our objective is. I mean, I think we also all agree that we should have longer maternity leaves, but that's not good from the point of view of closing the gender wage gap, because that means more time out of the labor force. So, I mean, I think this is my point generally, is like the needs of every family is really different. And I think that flexibility is really critical into helping women make the right choices for them and their families. And that's why policy just becomes far too blunt a tool. And sort of there are scope for policies certainly to make having children a better experience, a more rewarding experience, but they won't necessarily address the gender wage gap, but they do fix other problems.
Katie, why do you think that they will address the gender wage gap? I know you've said participation is part of what drives the wage gap right now, mm-hmm. but that excess time out, this could create a backlash, as Allison's arguing, against employers wanting to hire women. How do you look at that? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, we both hit on the motherhood penalty, which is a well-documented phenomenon, but we didn't talk about the fatherhood boost, which is the opposite effect. When men become fathers, they're not leaving the workforce, but they are getting it roughly about a 7% raise, because they're now seen as more responsible and committed to work because they have a family to care for. So interesting phenomenon. You know, on the flexibility piece, yes, women want it. That's why we have to advocate for parental leave and get more fathers to participate in leaving the workforce. Men don't. This is also well documented, because they're afraid of career setbacks, because they look at women and they go, oh, they're going to get a career setback, so I won't do it. And we have to change that. You know, in one of our provinces in Ontario, 84% of fathers actually take parental leave. And this is the province that has the lowest gender wage gap in the country.
Well, I feel like we've actually passed the Bechdel test with flying colors, because we haven't talked about men a lot in this. But actually, one of the things that I found so fascinating in preparing for this debate was, Allison, a piece you'd written in 2023 in Bloomberg. And it was looking at the decline of what you called prime age men. And I think you were showing data that it's now around, post-pandemic, it's about 88.5% of prime-age men are participating in the workforce. And while that's higher than the circa 77% of women, prime-age women who are working in the workforce, it's much lower than the 96-97% that we used to see in the 1960s or the 1970s. I'm curious how you, Allison, look at that data and the corollary data that women are primary breadwinners in. It's gone up from 5% of families in 1972 to about 16% today. It's, I think, 1 in 5 for college-educated women. I'm just curious how you look at this data and how men factor into all of this, besides their premium.
Actually, from a policy perspective, I'm actually more concerned and think we need more to help men, because I'm very concerned about their future in the labor market. I mean, Katie's talking a lot about getting more women to the labor force and feminization of industries, and that has been great for women. It's been great for me personally, not against that. But I think it also is that we're seeing the economy evolve, and probably with AI even further, to sort of jobs with better interpersonal skills being more valued. I think the outlook for women's work actually looks fantastic. But I am actually very concerned about more men leaving the labor force, which can have a lot of bad social knock-on effects. And I think the column you're referring to is, it's sort of been a mystery why so many prime-age men aren't working. I sort of came up with this theory when I was spending time in a brothel for research. And I was surprised that all the women I spoke to there, all the men in their world, were not working at all. Whether it was their brother, whether or not it was their partner, whether or not it was their father. And they were all there effectively supporting, like, this whole group of men. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why they didn't work, and it, you know, was different for everyone. And so when I did that story, I was looking and seeing that, you know, if men aren't working, we don't know how they're getting money. I mean, they're not, there's no evidence that disability rules have gone up significantly in or at least been a cause of this. And it does look that women earning more and being more active in the labor force might be to some degree, I don't want to say enabling, because, you know, men worked for years and women didn't work and no one thought there was anything wrong with that. Although arguably there's more social knock-on effects from men being out of the labor force. So it might just be that women, men having women in their lives working is also contributing to them not working just because it raises overall household income and they're making sort of that choice, which is probably, say, not for the best. Also, they're also facing, I think, trends in the labor force that make it harder for men.
Katie, are you worried about men?
No, because hiring salaries are a problem. Employers are still hiring white men and paying them more. But I just want to say the point that Allison's making about, you know, men working at home and women working at home and how this is shifting. And this is sort of the crux of the problem, is that we do not value women's unpaid care work, unpaid domestic work. And, you know, actually after World War II, Finland started tracking women's unpaid work as part, it was primarily women in the 50s still staying home, unpaid work in their GDP. And the League of Nations asked them to stop because it was skewing their GDP numbers so much. And what if we had actually said, no, this is a wonderful trend. Why don't we actually count the number of hours that contributes to our economic growth, because it's the unpaid care that's primarily done by women that holds up this economy. And if moving into that space is men, that's great. But really, this is what enables the economy to run.
Thank you, Katie. I'm going to ask you one last question before we wrap this part of the discussion. And that is around a curious statistic I saw where I think it was the Center for American Progress report said that Asian women actually out-earned white non-Hispanic men by a cent on the dollar. But I guess the question I'm asking is, are there other actual inequities that we're not looking at, racial inequities, because we're so focused on this gender question?
I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a whole other conversation to be had about intersectional identities with pay gaps, with all kinds of equity gaps and equity-seeking groups that deserve proper pay.
I think we're going to wrap our discussion there. We're going to continue the conversation around the question, should we address the gender wage gap? And we'll be inviting in some other voices to help us really probe at that question. That's after the break. Welcome back to Open to Debate. I'm your guest moderator, Naima Raza, and today we're tackling the question of should we address the gender wage gap? I'm joined by our debaters here today, Katie Ward-Philp of the Equal Pay Commission of Ontario, Canada, and Allison Schrager of the Manhattan Institute. We're going to bring in some other voices now, members of the audience who've been following along and I'm sure are itching to ask some questions. Up first, I'd like to invite in Stacey Vanek-Smith. Stacey is a host and correspondent of The Indicator from Planet Money on NPR. She's also the author of the book, which is fabulously titled Machiavelli for Women. Stacey, excited to hear your question.
I guess I have a slightly different question for Katie and for Allison. For Katie, I would love to know what you think the most effective policy solution would be in closing the wage gap. And for Allison, you mentioned that there is, when you control for everything, there is still a wage gap that's there. I think it's about 9%. I'm wondering what you think a good response to that wage gap would be. Do you think the free market is going to close it on its own? Is there a policy solution that would help that, or a company solution, or how you think we could go about addressing that as a society, maybe not just strictly policy?
Allison, do you want to go first on the question of what policy would work?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, Claudia Golden's work has shown that that remaining bit is largely that flexibility premium, that women really do crave or need flexibility, particularly if they become mothers. She argues that this isn't necessarily something that the policy can change, but she argues social norms. But I actually think the market is changing this already. And I mentioned earlier, largely because that premium on flexibility is getting cheaper for employers to offer through, as I said, remote work, through gig work. That's making work a lot more flexible. We're already seeing huge increases in participation for women. So I think that's going to go a long way of closing the gap, because being a flexible worker is all of a sudden becoming a lot less costly to employers. And that is really, I think, what's really been the stubborn bit.
And then Katie?
Thank you for your question, Stacey. You know, it's really hard to say what is the most effective policy in closing the gender wage gaps, because context really, really matters in terms of the way that the division of power is divided between maybe state and nation, and the local laws, all of these things really play a part. But one thing that we've seen really interesting conversation is this concept of comparable worth. So a lot of equal pay laws look at exactly that, equal pay for equal work. And there's emerging trend on equal pay for work of equal value. And it's actually Massachusetts is the only state that has comparable worth built into their law that says men and women do different jobs in the job market, and those have been valued differently for all these historical stereotypical bias reasons, and we're going to use different forms of gender-based analysis or removing gender bias from it and come to a section of comparable worth. And that's been really effective in certain contexts to understand and correct for the biases.
Thank you so much, Stacey, for your question. Up next, I'd like to bring on Stephanie O'Connell Rodriguez. Stephanie is a journalist. She pens the Too Ambitious newsletter, which is aimed at women. It covers ambition, money, power. Stephanie, welcome. What's your question for our debaters?
So assuming you accept the argument that the gender wage gap is simply a reflection of the conditions of the workplace, greedy work, long hours, and flexible schedules, my question would have to be, are those the ideal conditions of work for women or for men or for individuals across gender identity or even for employers or the economy as a whole? Or are the current conditions of work actually not conducive to maximizing productivity or well-being for most of us? And so maybe could addressing gender wage inequality also improve productivity and well-being and outcomes more broadly for everyone?
Thank you so much, Stephanie, for that question. I think I'll let you start on this one because I think you were making an argument about the economic potential of kind of addressing some of these gaps, which is around GDP, but this is connected.
Sure. I think that's a really important question because it brings up the fact that, you know, workplaces were essentially constructed for the male breadwinning model. And that's not what we see in today's workforce. So the workplace model has to change. And we go back to the pandemic, this sort of work from home forced us to think through what the new workplace could look for and how workplaces could work for women, how workplaces could work for men, how workplaces could work for all the intersectional identities you raised, Stephanie. I think that that's a huge part in figuring out how to close gender wage gaps by working with women and with others to figure out what is the ideal space and time for them to work in. And keeping in mind that the current structure was designed for the male breadwinner model, which is no longer the model in North America.
Thank you, Katie. Allison, how would you look at that question around, are these the ideal conditions? And if not, how do we address them? I mean, you've talked about the pandemic and post-pandemic shift to virtual and remote and flexible work being a part of this.
Yeah, I think Katie brought up a good point that the market is already doing this through technology of allowing more sort of creative ways around work and helping employers rethink this. But I think that's the way to do it because I think policy to impose this, we sort of get into sort of a very unproductive ways of this. For instance, I mean, if we want to make sure people put limits on how many hours people work, I think we find that like, for instance, the 35-hour work week in France ends up lowering output. It sort of shrinks GDP, it lowers income, or you find all these sort of creative ways to get around it, which end up sort of as well sort of benefiting some workers as not the other. So I agree that maybe, you know, the original way was not the best way, but I don't think it's the scope of a sort of blunt policy instruments to change that when technology is already doing that job.
Thank you so much for your question, Stephanie. Next up, I'm going to invite onto the stage Liz Lenz. She has a new book out, which is going to rival Stacey's for best titles, This American Ex-Wife. It's, yes, about divorce. And she also has a Substack called Men Yell at Me, another incredible title. It describes itself as being, quote, at the intersection of patriarchy and politics in red state America. Liz, come on with your question.
We're talking a lot about work flexibility, but a lot of my research, especially for my book, indicates that there's a flexibility myth out there. Specifically, the research done by Eve Rodsky's Fair Play Institute, where she found that women, even if they are in high-powered jobs, tend to see their jobs as less flexible, as more flexible, because they are required to be more flexible by our society, and their work is valued less. So she compared women who were doctors, women who were lawyers, and without fail, it was always women who were saying their jobs were more flexible because they had to be, because the burden of childcare always fell on them. So I'm wondering how like we address this myth of flexibility, and if we're devaluing women's participation in the workforce, are we also by extension devaluing men's participation as childcare and fathers? And does that disadvantage them as members of their families?
Allison, I think that one's probably for you.
So I'm not sure that it's a myth of flexibility. I mean, what we do see is that, as I said, women who don't have children or are married to lower income spouses tend to still work those hours. So they don't feel the flexibility imposed on them. To some degree, I mean, every family, I guess, does have to make a choice. And in some choice, and it's less common for men to sort of be in that role. That could be because, as I said, they tend to be in higher earning professions. Often, as I said, with the same study I'm thinking about from the University of Chicago, it looked at people who sort of paired off when they were MBA students, and the men tended to pursue higher earning jobs. So I'm not really sure if it's a myth, but I mean, I think certainly as society is evolving, as technology is evolving, I mean, we might sort of rethinking these sort of very long entrenched societal norms. But there is also evidence that a lot of women, and there is, I think we should celebrate this and not look at this as a problem to be solved, enjoy the time with their children and enjoy being mothers and really do want to be there during those years. I mean, that study found is the women who could afford to do so did take the most time off because they wanted to be mothers and they did work still. They did keep their toe in the labor market, but they also really relished that flexibility, and women who can afford to tend to want to.
Thank you, Allison. I don't know, Katie, if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I'll just hit on the point that Liz was making and asking, are we devaluing fathers' roles in parenthood? And I think that's an important piece of this conversation, because if we still continue to play a narrative that women want to be present, women want to be with the children, these are moments they don't want to miss, that's all absolutely true. And I think motherhood is a noble, beautiful, high calling. But I also think so is fatherhood. And so I think part of the conversation is saying, men have to be present too, except we still continue to put the burden on women to take this on because it's innate to her. It's part of, you know, her biology and all of these things. So we know that where there's shared parental leave options, men are taking them. We see that. So when men are given the choice and the opportunities, they also want to be active in parenthood and fatherhood when the structures and the policy systems enable them, and when also the social stigma doesn't make that an uncomfortable choice for them.
You're arguing for creating a fatherhood premium, not just for wage, but maybe actually for caring for the child as well.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for your question, Liz. We have one more questioner here today. I'd like to welcome in Emma Hinchliffe. She's a senior writer at Fortune. She writes the Broadsheet newsletter, and which focuses on women in the workplace. And she also has her own Substack, which is called You've Got ML, not email, but M-I-L. Welcome, Emma. What's your question today?
Thank you so much. You know, hearing about the ways that policy could maybe be the answer and could not be the answer, I'm curious what you think about what businesses can do and will do, kind of two separate questions to address the gender wage gap. When you look at something like the salary transparency law here in New York, you know, businesses threw a fit before it went into effect, but it's been pretty successful for a year, or, you know, work from home was beneficial for businesses until it wasn't. So what do you think businesses should do, and what are they willing to do without regulatory motivation?
Thank you for that question. Allison, we'll start with you. What do you think that businesses will do, should do?
Well, as I said, they have before. I mean, I think there was a reason why they didn't want to give their workers flexibility. It was very expensive. But I think, as we said, with technology, that is becoming less dear to employers. I think the pay transparency laws have had kind of a mixed bag when it comes to closing the pay gap. So far, the evidence suggests that it does close the pay gap, but it pretty much just means that it gives employers an excuse to pay men less, but not women more. So I'm not sure if that's the objective or how we want to close the pay gap.
You know, I work for a regulatory body that has the power to sort of enforce forced labor laws. And I take a page out of Roosevelt that says, speak softly and carry a big stick. We like it when business does the right thing and we do not have to enforce. That's a really wonderful thing. And so we see that happening. I think by and large, companies generally want to do the right thing. When we do pay equity audits, they're generally shocked when they see gender wage gaps because they don't believe that's part of their philosophy or their approach, and they're willing to correct it. I think on pay transparency, I was going to bring that up as well, because a lot of companies are doing it proactively without being in a state that's legislating it, because they see that it's helpful in terms of even just getting more higher quality candidates, because people are participating at a rate that's commensurable with the actual salary that's being offered. So, you know, there's opportunities. I think companies, there's a big DE&I push. There's more conversations, diversity, equity, inclusion, push. And there's more conversations about this in the marketplace. And companies who have are putting a premium on this as part of their brand strategy are doing really well and actually doing this. So we like to see that. We like to see companies taking the initiative. And we shall see if things like pay transparency or salary disclosure laws is another really new one emerging in the US, banning companies from asking for previous disclosure. Previous salary disclosure, how that's going to have an impact. And a lot of that is actually company driven. I think private sector has a significant role to play as well in being leaders in this and committed to closing gaps.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Emma, for that question. We'll move on to closing statements shortly. Before we do, I have one final question I have for both of you. I'm curious, was there any point in this debate where you were compelled by an argument that your opponent made? Maybe Allison, I'll start with you.
I share Katie's passion to get more women in the labor force, and certainly ways that they can feel like they can do that with more flexibility and not feel like they have to take a big hit for it. As I said, I'm just more attuned to that happening through more market-based forces, because I fear that a lot of the policy prescription she has will ultimately be counterproductive.
Thank you for that, Allison. Katie, same question for you. What did you find compelling or most compelling in Allison's argument?
I think she raised some really strong points about changing working conditions and, you know, flexibility being a high value to women and the way that workplaces need to shift to address that. And I think that's absolutely going to be part of closing gender wage gaps for women.
All right. I'm glad that we found things that we can agree on. Now's the time to bring it home with closing remarks. Katie, you have the first opportunity for a mic drop here. Give us one last reason to believe we should address the gender wage gap.
Well, you know, I'm going to say that if we start with the premise that women are just as capable as men, that they too desire financial stability, choice, housing, food security, and a comfortable retirement, it can't be true that the gender wage gap exists because women reject wealth and success en masse. Instead, I've been arguing that we need to examine the social norms and policy failures that funnel women into lower paid work, and which cultural ideas lead us to devalue work that is primarily done by women. I've argued that the gender wage gap did not actually appear organically. It was constructed intentionally to secure men's dominance in the paid workforce and to actually dissuade women from pursuing economic opportunities outside the home. The gender wage gap we see today is of similar human design, but through complacency and sort of a familiar reluctance to define how we value labor and productivity. Critics will often say it's complicated or too expensive to close a gender wage gap, but in a rapidly aging society with similarly rapid declining birth rates, I say it's risky to let the free market dictate what care work and child rearing are actually worth. Nurse and teacher shortage across the US are really just two examples of how an entire nation suffers when female-dominated professions are not valued. So it costs us all when women's economic and productive potential is not fully realized. It costs us all when fair compensation is left up to biased markets. And it costs us when we allow inertia to continue to constrain the potential of young women and girls. So policy tools can help us right old wrongs. And what remains is actually finding the political will. We cannot expect women to be able to compete in an economy designed to exclude them. If we truly value equal opportunity, we need to level the playing field for women.
Thank you, Katie, for that closing argument. Allison, you're going to have the last word here. Convince us why we should not address this gender wage gap.
So I don't know if anyone remembers it. I can't believe it was 12 years ago now. There was a cover story on The Atlantic from Anne-Marie Slaughter called "You Can't Have It All." And it was all anyone talked about for at least a month. And here was this woman, this star Princeton professor with this high-flying government job, had a lot of power, a lot of prestige. And she realized she needed to take a step back and be home with her teenage children. And she was like, you know what? You can't have it all. I can't have this level of career that involves all of me and be the mother I want to be. And, you know, at the time, there was obviously rightly calling it out for being, you know, this is an incredibly privileged woman. She made a lot of money. Not only that, she had a husband who was willing to be there for the kids. I mean, she still just felt like it wasn't enough for her. So most women, overwhelming majority, do not have all those things going for them. But I think that story still really struck a chord with America and a lot of countries, because mothers all over the world do feel that. They feel that at various times in their children's lives, in their work lives, they need that flexibility. They need to be there. And that's why, one, we have this gender pay gap, because that flexibility ultimately is expensive. It's expensive to employers and it's expensive to women. But also, it's incredibly idiosyncratic. I don't want the message to be, you can't be an executive and a mother. Of course you can be. Some women can, some women can't. At different times in their life, there are different needs. But that's exactly why policy is too blunt a tool to do this, especially with all the technology we have in the pipeline, making work so much more flexible. We don't need to be told how much women need to be paid. We don't need some central planner deciding which jobs are worth more than the other. The market is already doing a good job and is much better suited to provide sort of women with the idiosyncratic flexibility they need.
Thank you, Allison. And that concludes our debate. I'd like to thank our debaters, Katie Ward-Philp and Allison Schrager. We so appreciate you showing up. You're approaching this debate with an open mind and you're bringing thoughtful disagreement to the table. So in short, you're being open to debate. I'd also like to thank my fellow journalists, interrogators for bringing their provocative questions to the table. I think it added a lot. So thank you, Stacey, Stephanie, Liz, and Emma. And finally, a big thank you to you, our audience, for tuning in to this episode of Open to Debate. As a nonprofit working to combat extreme polarization through civil debate, our work is made possible by listeners like you, the Rosenkranz Foundation, and supporters of Open to Debate. Robert Rosenkranz is our chairman, our CEO is Clea Connor, and Leah Mathau is our chief content officer. This episode was produced by Alexis Pancrazzi and Marlette Sandoval. Editorial and research by Gabriella Mayer and Andrew Foote. Andrew Lipson and Max Fulton provided production support. Millie Shaw is the Director of Audience Development. And the Open to Debate team also includes Gabrielle Iannicelli, Rachel Kemp, Linda Lee, and Devin Shermer. Damon Whittemore mixed this episode. Our theme music is by Alex Clement. And I'm Naima Raza. We'll see you next time on Open to Debate.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.